Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for listening to our podcast. It's supported by advertising, so after this brief message, we'll get right into it.
You know, it's shocking that your home can be stolen this easily. That's the brutal lesson Deborah learned when thieves found her home's title online, forged it, and literally took ownership of her home. In an instant, thieves legally owned Deborah's home. She got evicted and spent a fortune in legal fees trying to get it back. You know, the FBI calls home title fraud one of the fastest growing crimes, and you do not want to be next. That's why I urge you to protect the online title to your home with Home Title Lock. You know, the legal documents to our homes are kept online, where thieves hunt them. They forge the documents stating you sold your home. Then they borrow against your home and stick you with the payments. And no insurance or bank protects you. Home Title Lock does.
You could already be a victim of title fraud and not know it. Find out. Register your home at HomeTitleLock.com and enter WATCH for 1 month of free protection. Again, enter WATCH for 1 month free at HomeTitleLock.com. HomeTitleLock.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Bernie Sanders has rolled out his plan to pay for absolutely everything he's proposing. Elizabeth Warren had done this some time ago. Now Bernie has. There's a lot of overlap between both of their proposals. Not much. It's not to say that they're identical, but, you know, philosophically and structurally, they're very, very, very close. And it's just common sense. It's basically undoing Reaganomics. You know, prior to Ronald Reagan, the top tax rate in the United States was 74%. Reagan dropped that down to 28% in the 1980s. And that 74% top tax rate and the corporate tax rate was over 35%. During the Eisenhower administration, for example, corporate income taxes paid for fully one-third of the cost of government. Now it's down to like 5%. So basically, if we just roll back Reaganism, we've got enough money to pay for all these programs. And Bernie isn't even talking about really rolling back Reaganism. I mean, keep in mind, as I said, you know, the top tax rate during the Franklin D. Roosevelt administration was 91%. During the Harry Truman administration was 91%. Truman wasn't complaining about it. During the Eisenhower, all 8 years of Dwight Eisenhower, Republican, it was 91%. Dwight Eisenhower wasn't complaining about it. John Kennedy, 91%. Lyndon Johnson, 91%. Richard Nixon, 91%. Well, actually, Lyndon Johnson dropped it down to 74%. So then it became 74% for Richard Nixon, 74% for Jerry Ford, 74% for Jimmy Carter. And during that period of time, we had the most robust economy, the fastest growth of the American middle class, literally in the history of our country, which came to a screeching halt when Donald Trump, or when Ronald Reagan dropped that top tax rate. And this is, I mean, along with unions, the main driver of building that middle class was that top tax rate, because what it did was, instead of, you know, people accumulating more and more cash in their own private Swiss bank account, instead of the Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates of the world becoming you know, multi-billionaires, and keep in mind $1 billion is $1 million 1,000 times, and then you get tens of billions of dollars. It's mind-boggling, the amounts of money. That just didn't used to happen. Because instead of taking the money out and sticking it in their checking account, or, you know, however they would do it, people like Mark Zuckerberg back in the day would reinvest that money in their company and pay their employees better. You know, that top tax rate actually encouraged the growth of small and medium business, as well as made large businesses healthy. So Bernie has laid this out in a very straightforward fashion. I'll just go through it very quickly for you. He wants to expand Social Security so that everybody on low-income senior citizens and people with disabilities will get an additional $1,300 a year by increasing benefits. How is he going to do this? He's going to have the wealthiest 1.8% of Americans, that's people who make more than $250,000 a year, pay the same Social Security tax that you pay and that I pay. And that, by the way, will extend the solvency of Social Security to 2070 and beyond. I mean, that's just like, that's the end point for the math. He wants to end homelessness. That's going to cost $2.5 trillion. How does he do that? He puts a wealth tax on the top 0.1%. You have to have at least $32 million, and you are going to start paying a tax on your wealth, just like I pay and probably you pay a wealth tax on your property, on your house. And even if you're renting, you're paying a wealth tax. It's called a property tax. Every year, you know, your house may be worth, say, you know, $100,000. But every year, year after year after year, you still have to pay that property tax. That's a wealth tax that the middle class has been paying for generations. And all Bernie and Elizabeth Warren are both saying is, let's have the multimillionaires and billionaires pay a wealth tax on the money in their money bin. Right? If they want to take a deep dive and, you know, and swim in their piles of money in their money bin, just pay a property tax on it. And we're not even talking about a property tax that's anywhere as high as what the middle class pays on real estate property. And this would be a property tax that's like, you know, 0.1%, or at the most 1%, was Elizabeth Warren's suggestion. Universal pre-K, that'll cost $1.5 trillion. Again, that wealth tax will cover that. Eliminating medical debt. There's $81 billion in past due medical debt held by 79 million Americans. And Bernie just wants to completely pay that off. And how does he do that? With a income inequality tax on large corporations that pay their CEOs more than 50 times what their workers make. Keep in mind, when Ronald Reagan came into office in 1980, the average American CEO made 30 times what his lowest paid worker makes. Now it's hundreds to thousands of times. Bernie is saying if your company makes more than 50 times, or pays more than 50 times to your CEO, then that tax is going to go up. And that's going to pay for universal pre-K. The Green New Deal, this is $16.5 trillion. And he's going to pay for this by, number one, raising $3 trillion by making the fossil fuel industry pay for their pollution. Gee, what a novel idea. Secondly, generating $6.4 trillion in revenue from the wholesale energy that is produced by the power marketing administrations. By the way, if we replace our energy systems with renewable energies, after 2035, electricity will be virtually free outside of maintenance and operation costs. He wants to reduce defense spending by $1.2 trillion. But it's not just let's cut defense. Specifically, the part of defense spending that Bernie wants to cut is that $1.2 trillion a year that we spend protecting shipping lanes for oil coming to the United States. It's a subsidy to the oil industry. He wants to eliminate that. He'll pay for the Green New Deal with a $2.3 trillion in a new income tax revenue on the 20 million new jobs that are going to be created by the Green New Deal. This is sort of like the way that the GI Bill paid for itself back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, was because people who went to college for free on the GI Bill made more in income, and so they paid more in taxes, and that's what, you know, this is the same thing. And he's going to raise $2 trillion in revenue by having large corporations pay their fair share of taxes. And by the way, we'll save $70 trillion over the next 80 years if we can get global warming under control. And if we don't, it's going to cost us $34 trillion by the end of the century. He pays for his Medicare for All with a 4% income-based premium tax paid by employees who make more than $29,000 a year. If you make less than $29,000 a year, you pay nothing and you get complete health care. make more than $29,000, it's a 4% tax. This is pretty much what you're paying right now as your Medicare tax. It might be slightly higher. I'm not sure exactly what the Medicare part of FICA is. But in 2018, last year we have numbers for, the average, the typical working family paid $6,015 in premiums. Under this option, the typical family of four is going to pay $1,240 a year in premiums. So the average family of four is, who makes more than $29,000 a year, will save almost $5,000 a year, $4,700 a year. And if you make less than 29 grand a year, you pay nothing. And then he's going to, now right now, employers also have to pay into FICA to cover the employer's portion of the Medicare costs. That will be a 7.5% tax. But if you have a small business like mine, I mean, I've got a small company here. We've got, I think, three full-time employees and four or five part-time employees. And a company like ours that has less than $1 million in payroll will pay nothing, nothing, which will help small businesses. Boy, am I excited about that. Because in 2018, employers like me paid an average of $14,000 per employee in private health insurance premiums. And that's going to go to zero. So, you know, I'll save money. And the average family will save $4,500. He's going to raise the top marginal income tax rate to 52% on income over $10 million. Keep in mind, it was at 74% when Ronald Reagan came into office. It was at 91% when Lyndon Johnson came into office. And the economy did better during that period of time than any time in the history of the United States. He's going to tax capital gains. In other words, Paris Hilton sitting on her butt getting her dividend checks. That's how she makes her living. Right now, she pays almost nothing in taxes, 15%. He's going to raise that up to, you pay the same thing. If you make your money with money, you're going to pay the same income taxes if you make your money laying bricks or doing a radio show or whatever it may be. He's going to close the loopholes in the estate tax. That'll raise money. $2.5 trillion over 10 years, and he's going to raise the corporate income tax rate to 35%. All of that will pay for the Green New Deal. And the math actually works. So just FYI, in our program today, Marion Smith, he is going to be with us. He's the executive director of Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. He'll be with us, and he's going to tell us how terrible Bernie Sanders is because he's a communist. This is going to be fascinating. And so I'm going to be asking him, well, what part of our socialism you want to get rid of? You know, is Social Security? Medicare, disability, saving our environment, doing away with student debt, police, fire, public roads, public schools, what? What's it going to be? I also want to get into some conversations about what's going on with the coronavirus and the stock market and all that kind of stuff. So we have a big day today and a lot coming up. So please stick around with us. And we will be back in just a few minutes. I'll be taking your calls here on the Tom Hartman program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, as we defend America from the weapons of mass deception. So stick around. We'll be right back. A lot on our plate, a lot to talk about. Oh, and Bernie praising Cuba. Let me get to that, too.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
But I've got a clip of Obama saying the same thing. Stick around. Let's see here. Patrick, watching Free Speech TV in Long Island, New York. Hey, Patrick, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing today?
I am great, but I'll get better.
You'll get better. I have a comment and a question. My first comment is on Bernie's just released financial projections, you know, his taxes. He's going to be painted as he'll raise your taxes when the average person has nothing to do with this.
He's actually, if you make $29,000 a year or less, you're no longer going to be paying a Medicare FICA tax. So your taxes are actually going to go down.
Which will be fine.
But if you make $35 million a year or more, your taxes are going to go up. I'm sorry, Patrick.
Yeah, no, correct, as we said. But he'll be labeled with the tax or whatever.
Yeah, I don't think people are buying that crap anymore. I really don't.
I hope they don't, because as I said, for the average person, it has nothing to do with you unless you have a trust fund and a pool of the ground, you know?
Yeah.
My question I wanted to ask was, how much money and staff has been cut from the various NIH, the CDC, the various medical agencies that we have set up to deal with something like this virus? And that's the question.
Trump has basically shut down. There were two major institutional bodies in the federal government. One was associated with the National Security Administration. The other was associated with the Department of Homeland Security. There were directors for both those programs. programs. These were epidemic disease prevention programs and treating, you know, dealing with epidemics. Mostly they were set up during the Obama administration during the outbreak of Ebola in Africa. One of them, I believe, goes back to the Bush administration also and was also designed to deal with things like the Ebola outbreak. Trump nuked them both. He fired both those leaders. There is a third agency also that has been around for quite a while that Trump tried to zero out last year, and Congress wouldn't go along with it. Congress put it back in the budget. And so as of right now, what Trump has been doing is refusing to hire new people when people retire, you know, or quit their jobs at that agency. So that agency is staffed at about half strength, and it's a relatively minor agency. And right now, nobody's in charge of this. You'd think that the Centers for Disease Control would be in charge of our response to the coronavirus. No. The decisions are actually being made by Mike Pompeo, who has absolutely no public health knowledge at all, and by the State Department. It was the State Department, for example, who decided to fly those coronavirus-infected people back into the United States. Trump is rather upset about that, by the way, because, you know, he likes to be the fear-monger in chief. And, oh, my God, you know, his own administration isn't helping with this.
So once again, under the president's duties are to protect and, you know, safeguard the public, and we have somebody who's failed.
Not only has he failed terribly, but also without a national public health system, we are unprepared for any kind of serious problem. I mean, you've got right now as we speak, there are outbreaks of multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis in both New York and Los Angeles that, you know, we're doing almost nothing about. You've got hookworm disease spreading across the American South as a result of poverty, and people have no access to health care because we have no national health care system. So we, of all the developed countries in the world, we are the least prepared to deal with an epidemic outbreak. Patrick, thanks for the call. It's great to hear from you, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Tom Hartman here. My new book, The War on Voting, it should be titled The Republican War on Voting, which is what it really is, Who Stole Your Vote and How to Get It Back. It is the third in the series, the Hidden History series. The first was Guns and the Second Amendment. The second was the Supreme Court, the Betrayal of America. We're doing a book tour on the voting book here, Friday the 28th of February in Portland at Powell's on Burnside, and Sunday in Chicago on March 1st. You can check it all out at tomhartman.com. All the information is there. David in Los Angeles, listening on KPFK. Hey, David, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Always a pleasure to talk to you. As your biggest French fan, I just want to thank you for your wonderful show.
Thank you.
So just a couple of observations about Bernie. I just wanted to tell your listeners that Bernie would be seen as a moderate in Europe. So that's one thing.
Yep.
So there's nothing communist about what he says. So when I heard Mike Bloomberg calling him kind of communist, it's laughable. You know?
It is laughable.
It's ridiculous. Second thing I wanted just to share with you quickly is that I noticed that Americans are extremely worried about paying more taxes, but something they don't realize, they pay way more fees than we do in Europe, you know? And
Interesting. And you were saying is in Europe, people don't pay as much in fees, but you do pay more in taxes, but you get a lot more for those taxes, David.
We do get a lot more, Tom, and especially when it comes, because, you know, Bernie is all about the universal health care, and we do, in Europe, we do pay less fees, especially when it comes to the, for example, when you go to the hospital, when you get a surgery, you're going to get, maybe 15 bucks to go to the hospital.
Oh, so there's basically no co-pays and no surprise billing and, you know, no in-network, out-of-network, all that other kind of nonsense. Basically, you get sick, you get treated, period. End of discussion.
Yes, indeed. You're a human being, and it should be a right and not a product.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds like a plan. David, thank you for the call. It's great to hear from you. David in Neckline, Wisconsin, says you want to disagree with me about what?
The wealth tax, and it's actually Mequon, Wisconsin.
Okay.
So you're correct in what you stated earlier, that property tax is a wealth tax. The difference is real estate is very stable. Obviously, you get taxed for the property, and you get taxed for the land. And you can make a very easy assessment as to, you know, what the property is worth on a year-to-year basis. Whereas the wealth tax that you're speaking of, keep in mind, you're not paying income tax on your house. So the tax that you're talking about, you're already paying corporate tax or paying income taxes. Now you're talking about a wealth tax, but the difference is...
Well, hang on just a second, David. I paid income tax on every single penny that I used to buy my house. If you're arguing double taxation, I'm not buying it.
Well, at the end of the day, you have to look, as far as money and global, you can liquidate things a lot quicker in the financial sector than you can in the real estate sector. So I think it's conjecture that the money that he would raise would not actually be there, because if you look at like Italy and other countries in Europe, you have whole shadow economies because of the fact that they do have high VAT taxes and other things. So you have two different economies.
You're always going to have people evading taxes. We have that here in the United States. But the fact of the matter is, if somebody's sitting on more than $35 million in assets and they're confronted with a 1% wealth tax and they say, you know, I think I'll liquidate some of those assets to avoid paying that tax, and they put that money back into their company or they pay their employees better, I think that's a good thing. That's the whole point of it. David, thank you for the call. Sorry, I can't agree with you. We'll be up next with Marion Smith, the Executive Director of Victims of Communism.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Is communism coming to the United States soon? Let's find out.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our book on the Tom Hartman Book Club today is Cuban Women Confront the Future. It's an interview with Vilma Espin. Vilma Espin was the president of the Federation of Cuban Women since its founding in 1960, and was the chair of the Commission for Social Prevention and president of the Infancy Institute and the International Federation of Democratic Women. And it's a long-form interview, actually, the book. So the first question, what does socialism mean in the lives of a Cuban family, and in particular, Cuban woman, Vilma Espin? For the Cuban family, especially the woman, socialism has meant an enormous improvement to the quality of life and personal development. We should remember that until January 1, 1959, in our country, hunger, poverty, exploitation, repression, and dependence reigned. The revolution opened up new horizons in the economic, political, and social fields, and amongst its key principles is the defense of equal rights for all human beings. The constant struggle to make ends meet disappeared, and with it the antagonism between people competing for the crumbs that could help them escape the tragic destiny that awaited the majority. Thus the family, the basic cell of society, could develop in a rounded way. Our revolution assured all Cubans the chance to exercise each one of their inalienable rights. Each citizen is assured that food prices are reasonable and that education and medical services are free. The state makes a systemic effort to improve living standards to the extent that it is permitted by the tense battle for development that we wage under blockade and constant imperialist threats. Childcare facilities have been created to provide care for the children of tens of thousands of working women from the age of 3 months to 6 years. Services to lighten domestic work have been created. Hundreds of thousands of students have also received free lunch at day school and all their meals at boarding school. Hundreds of thousands of workers also receive their meals at a moderate price in their workplace. More industrial laundries and dry cleaners have been established, and more domestic labor-saving devices are available with preference in acquisition and cheaper prices for workers. Huge resources are dedicated to housing construction in urban and rural zones. We also try to guarantee recreational facilities and spiritual enjoyment to all the population. Of course, the possibilities are exciting, but also what we have achieved to date, considering our limitations, is already vastly superior to what families experienced in the past. Social Security provides an income for those who cannot work. As far as women are concerned, equal rights have certainly changed their position in the family and in society. A woman's participation in social production, because it implies her financial independence, has altered her dependent position in the marriage and allowed a change in her ideas, in the way she looks at life. The laws that govern family relations, such as the Family Code, are based on equality and guarantee the right of members of the family to participate in society, to work, study, and to responsibly educate the children in line with our revolutionary principles. This does not mean that we achieved all that we aspire to. We still have problems of a material nature to resolve, which are directly related to our economic development. There is still the need to eliminate backward ideas that some people hold, men and women, with respect to the role that each person should play within the home, the nature of the socialist family and the relationship between a couple, ideas which work against the full participation of women in the building of a new society. Obviously, the economic security guaranteed by both men and women having access to work, free health care, and education, the obvious satisfaction and confidence in oneself, that equal opportunity and the chance to fully develop to the extent of one's talents, intelligence, and aptitude offer to each person, The constant motivation and emotional stability that comes from feeling useful, recognized, and dignified as a human being. Everything that socialism has brought to us undoubtedly fulfills the deepest desires of a family, particularly the woman, who until just a quarter century ago was exploited, oppressed, and marginalized in the family and in society. Question: what is the primary concern in Cuba, work or the human being? What place do women occupy within this concern? Velma Aspin. In Cuba, a country that is building socialism, the highest aim is human happiness, based on respect for the fundamental human rights of each person. That includes full social equality to education, health care, work, and professional training, with the chance to employ all of one's faculties to take an active role in society and to help develop that society, to create the material and spiritual basis for a full, harmonious life, where the highest qualities of both men and women flourish. To reach those aspirations requires work, talent, dedication, and willingness from everybody. It requires constant scientific and technological innovation to assure economic and social development. Thus, each member of our society, along with the right to work and all the benefits brought by the revolution, has acquired the duty to help create the economic basis necessary for such advantages. The building of a new society and the fulfillment of new aspirations could not possibly be achieved except on the basis of work and the willingness of the whole population. And the people work with enthusiasm because work is the means for creating wealth and goods for all to enjoy. Work that is free from exploitation does require a new dimension, a quality that stimulates and produces satisfaction. To feel that you are useful and are creating your destiny, to project yourselves toward the future through your work, to cultivate the future. In a speech in January 1964, Che Guevara said that when each Cuban viewed work as a vital expression of their human creativity, technology, technique, and inventions would proceed apace, and all would participate with an uncontainable force in building the new society. The book, Cuban Women Confront the Future, by Velma Aspin. So, you look in the mirror and you see those wrinkles around your eyes, crow's feet, under-eye bags. Now, just imagine that they're gone. And I'm not talking about going in for some kind of risky, expensive surgery. Just gone in minutes. It's called Plexaderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. You can see the demonstrations over on their website at triplexaderm.com. They actually have videos of this in 10 minutes or less. In just a few minutes, you see these radical changes. It's remarkable. You look 10 years younger. I'm blown away by the results. Plexaderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is Plexaderm goes on clear, so nobody will know you're using it. Unless, of course, you tell them. Go to triplexaderm.com and use my code VOICES for 50% off a full-size bottle of Plexaderm, plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning the code VOICES. Plexaderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit triplexaderm.com today and use the code VOICES at checkout. That's triplexaderm.com, code VOICES. Coming up in the Science Revolution this week, I explain why biodiversity matters and what happens when we lose biodiversity. Margaret Butler from the Extinction Rebellion is here about the activists fighting against oil trains and what happened to them. Dr. David Reichmuth also joins me on the impact of electric cars and find out why people are adding mushrooms to their coffee. That's the Science Revolution, wherever fine podcasts are available. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. And on the line with us is Marion Smith. Marion is the executive director of the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, a beautiful website, victimsofcommunism.org. The Twitter handle is Smith Marion, M-A-R-I-O-N. Marion, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. I am no fan of communism. I lived for a year in West Germany, right on the border with East Germany. In fact, in the spring, when we were in Herheim, literally, I mean, the border was 80 or 90 yards from the back of our house. And as the ground thawed in the spring, the landmines that the East Germans had put in between the two giant rows of fence, you know, the earth would move as it thawed, and it would set off the landmines, and we'd be woken up at, you know, as the sun came up with the explosions in our backyard. My daughter and I visited East Berlin and spent a day there, and not a place I'd want. And my wife and I visited Moscow back when it was the Soviet Union. Not a good place, not a good system. But I understand that you are concerned that some of the Democrats and some of our millennials want to go to that kind of system. Do I have that right? The press release I got from you essentially says that in fact, I'll quote from it, in America, socialism and communism mean for those on the left the same thing. And the latest poll shows that 70% of millennials say they'd vote for a socialist. Explain.
Well, it is true that there is a sort of all-time high in positive opinions of both socialism and communism. And we have conducted a poll with YouGov for the last 4 years, and the most recent findings we published in this past fall. And yes, it did find that 70% say they would either vote for a socialist or a communist. That breakdown, and this is millennials and Gen Zers, 50% say they'd vote for a socialist, 20% say vote for a communist. And
But hang on just a second. 20% of Americans, anytime you get down into those low percentages, you know, 20% of Americans don't know the three branches. Actually, it's more like 60% of Americans don't know the three branches of government. 20% of Americans believe just like crazy stuff, you know, like the earth is flat. That's like 17% of Americans will poll to that. So 20% of Americans say they voted for communism doesn't seem real impressive to me. But socialism, you know, what part of socialism is it that you don't like? Do you want to do away with, you know, I drove on our socialist roads to get to work here today, protected by our socialist police departments. My home is safe while I'm at work because, and my office here is safe because we have a socialist fire department. I'm able to read your press release because I went to a socialist public school. What part of socialism is it that you so hate?
Well, on the poll numbers, so those are numbers reflecting the opinions of those under the age of 37-38, so Gen Zers and millennials. And when you compare that to generations above them, you see this drastic shift.
Well, that's because young people don't remember the communism of the Soviet Union. It was terrible stuff. But they're frankly, I think that they're starting to learn about the communism of China. You've got a million people in concentration camps right now, the Uyghurs that the Chinese have there. That's communism. But that's not what any of our Democratic candidates are talking about. I mean, your press release here says that Bernie Sanders is pushing this stuff. You know, he's talking nicely about Fidel Castro.
To be clear, the system putting 1 to 3 million Muslim Uyghurs in concentration camps is called socialism with Chinese characteristics. So neither you nor I get to redefine the intellectual and the historical meaning of socialism and communism. And that, I think, is the concern for many Americans who see a sort of normalization of the term socialism. And for those who understand that in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics and all of the Soviet and Socialist Workers' Parties throughout Central and Eastern Europe, they understood themselves to be socialist, trying to get to the end state of communism. And so I do not subscribe to the idea that there is this vast distinction between socialism and communism. Marx didn't think so. Lenin didn't think so. And each of the regimes in the some 40 nations ruled by communist parties trying to make socialist policies work, they didn't think so either.
I would submit that those were different times and those words had different meanings back then. And we had no experience in the from the 1860s forward after Karl Marx's, after Das Kapital was published. You know, we had no experience of actual communism and the horrors of actual communism. The only communism we'd experienced basically was a kibbutz in Israel, which was kind of a friendly communism. But
And I've actually lived on a kibbutz for a time in Israel. And, you know, I am a full endorser of all of the voluntary socialist experiments that have existed for hundreds of years.
Sure. But they only work in small societies. When society gets large enough that politicians can behave in fraudulent fashion, as they did in the Soviet Union, that's where communism really starts to break down. And I think we're going to agree on that. I would like to get to your criticism of Bernie Sanders. You argued that because on 60 Minutes a couple nights ago, and Mike Bloomberg has been making the same argument, that Bernie pointed out that when Castro came to power, He gave people free education. The illiteracy rate in Cuba was, as I recall, well over 70%. And now it's less than 1%, less than 1 or 2%. It's everybody in Cuba is literate. And my wife and I visited Cuba last year, spent a week there, and even the poorest of people have perfect teeth and everybody has good health. Their child mortality rate is actually lower than the United States. Their lifespan is equivalent to or higher than the United States. So in those two areas, you know, they've done a good thing, I would think. And lest we forget, President Obama said the exact same thing that Bernie said. President Obama opened the United States to Cuba. He reached out to Cuba. He tried to bring us all together. I mean, it was just very, very straightforward stuff. Keep in mind, Bernie on 60 Minutes said, you know, he's a dictator, but he did give everybody health care and education. Now, we're not dictators. We should be able to do the same, right? And we're better than that. Here's what Obama said.
And I said this to President Castro in Cuba. I said, look, you've made great progress in educating young people. Every child in Cuba gets a basic education. That's a huge improvement from where it was. Medical care. The life expectancy of Cubans is equivalent to the United States, despite it being a very poor country, because they have access to health care. That's a huge achievement. They should be congratulated. But you drive around Havana and this economy is not working. It looks like it did in the 1950s. And so you have to be practical in asking yourself, how can you achieve the goals of equality and inclusion?
So Bernie Sanders' words were almost verbatim the same thing. So what's wrong with that? Well, you know, outside of the fact that Bernie was even more emphatic. You know, he said, you know, the Castro administration and the current administration, they're tyrants, they're dictators. We condemn them. What's your problem with it?
Well, the problem is you cannot trust the Cuban Communist Party's statistics. So anybody who cites those as the sole source of any information about life inside of Cuba is relying on, you know, verifiably inaccurate information. The second thing is that the life expectancy for a political dissident in Cuba is well below global averages.
And that's what we're all attacking. I agree with you.
And when it comes to literacy, you know, you might have some more people who can read than before 1959, but they're not free to read what they want. And even for those who still can't read in Cuba, because I can introduce you to some people in rural provinces in Cuba who have been punished for trying to set up schools in underserved communities there. But even for those people who cannot read, they are not allowed to talk about things that are deemed to be a threat to the Communist Party.
Agreed, and these are the things that Bernie Sanders criticized.
Why praise the Cuban Communist Party? I mean, if you look at what they have supported in Venezuela, they have turned that country. There is less literacy. There is less health care.
Oh, Venezuela is melting down, and Bernie Sanders recently called Maduro a dictator there as well. But when President Obama was praising the fact that the Cubans had universal education and universal health care, he was simply stating a fact. I mean, we may not like what it is that they're learning in
true.
Their schools.
Universal health care is not a fact of life in Cuba. It's a propaganda talking point.
It wasn't the Cuba I saw. Have you been there?
You had minders, and you were not allowed
to
take a Jeep and go into the interior.
We absolutely
did. You were not allowed to.
We absolutely did. We were driving all over the country all by ourselves.
Then you should have met some people I would have introduced you to who could have given you the other side of the story. And these people exist, and they were excluded from the
embassy. I know that there are dissidents
who
are opposed to the system. But this just seems like, you know, hyperbolic hysteria, frankly. No Democratic candidate is suggesting that the United States should adopt the Cuban political system. None. And as far as education and healthcare goes, it's, you know, the Cuban system is also the Denmark system, the Sweden system, the Norway system, the France system, the Germany system. You know,
I don't agree with that.
Pick your European country.
No, I don't agree with that.
The Canadian system.
The leaders of Scandinavia and Denmark deny that. They do not say they're a socialist system. They're a market economy, a democracy. And when Bernie Sanders in 2016
they call it democratic
Denmark a socialist country, the Prime Minister of Denmark said it's not true. There is a difference between advocating high-tax welfare policies, which many Western European countries do, and instituting a more Marxist idea of socialism that denies the idea of individual rights in favor of collective justice. And when a candidate asked 20 years ago what they view as socialism, and they point to Venezuela and Cuba, that tells you what they view socialism to be in reality.
Yeah, and I get that. Marion Smith is the executive director of Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. Victimsofcommunism.org is the website. You can tweet him at Smith Marion, M-A-R-I-O-N. Marion, thanks for dropping by.
Hey, good to talk. Thanks.
Yeah, back at you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with your calls and thoughts on all this right after the break. Interesting to hear Obama saying what Bernie's being criticized for, huh? Tom Harbin here with you, and let's see here, David in Los Angeles. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Yes, Tom, what I originally picked up to call you for was this thing with the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
But before I touch on that real quickly, Tom.
Sure.
When we're doing history, see, during the time of the Cold War, America was in the height of apartheid or Jim Crow.
You're right.
This was a time to which colonialism, including here in South America and throughout the world, colonialism was a state of affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Cuba was the little playground, a little whore under Batista, under...
sure, for the mafia with Batista. He was stripping his people. I mean, people were dying, literally dying of hunger in Cuba when Batista was president.
We do history, you know, with all of this Cold War nonsense, this jingoism, elementary Americana pox of madness, right?
Yeah.
It's history, which is nonsense. And further, and then I'll go over to this. The prison population in the United States, with 5% of the population, we got millions of people in prison today.
Right.
We have millions of people without medical today.
Yes.
And this takes me to this pandemic that seems to be shooting throughout the world.
Okay.
With no so-called socialist medicine here in the United States, I fear for our survival if something like that occurred. Because this nonsense that we have in the way of a patchwork of pay for service medical...
Mm-hmm.
Right? With all of the people already dying, or with no pandemic or no epidemic, right?
Yep.
I pray, and I'm a praying man, that this thing that's happening in China and in the creek without a pedal.
Yeah, I get it.
Yep, sir. Yeah, you okay. Got it, brother. But that's it.
Okay. The simple reality is that the thing that provides resilience to a nation is a national healthcare system, resilience in the face of a possible epidemic or pandemic. And President Obama got us a whole lot closer to that with the Affordable Care Act, and now you've got 20-some-odd Republican-controlled states and the Trump administration suing at the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has said, we're going to move this back until after the election so nobody knows about it, but suing to allow health insurance companies to start denying coverage to people because of pre-existing conditions and because they've cost more than $1 million in their lifetime. This is what Trump wants to bring back to America. And this is just so wrong. And without a national healthcare system, we are far more vulnerable to that coronavirus epidemic than, frankly, any of the other developed countries in the world. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Wanted to give you the latest news about my good friend Bill Press. Bill no longer does his progressive morning show, but that doesn't mean he's gone away. No way. He's now out with a great new podcast, the Bill Press Pod, dropped twice a week. Check out the Bill Press Pod for Bill's interviews with some of the country's leading progressives like Maxine Waters, Mark Pocan, Jamie Raskin, all roasting Donald Trump. Plus, his lively end-of-the-week roundtable with three of Washington's top political reporters commenting on the latest craziness from the White House, Congress, and the 2020 Democratic primary. For years, Bill Press has been one of the leading progressive voices in our country, so I'm so glad he's still out there on the left and stronger than ever. I encourage you to join me by subscribing to Bill's new podcast. Just go to wherever you get your podcast, search for the Bill Press Pod, click on subscribe, and you're in for a true progressive experience on the Bill Press Pod. Check out Bill's new podcast, The Bill Press Pod, dropped twice a week. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. David in Chicago. Hey, David, what's up?
I just wanted to get your opinion on, it seems like there's a lot of fighting between, you know, what side people lie politically on.
Right.
And I just wanted to get your opinion on trying to hear other voices. You know, if you're liberal and you watch MSNBC all day, you only get half of the story. If you're conservative and you only listen to Fox News all day, you only get that side of the story. And obviously you're...
What half of the story are liberals who watch MSNBC missing?
Off the top of my head, I would say more facts about gun control. Personally, that's a big issue for me.
What facts about gun control are not being discussed on CNN or MSNBC?
First, this isn't what I called to talk about.
No, but you made this assertion. I agree with you that Fox News regularly lies to their viewers, misinforms their viewers, and in fact, two different university studies have found that people who watch Fox News not only have a lower level of information about the actual events of the day than do people who watch no news, but they actually believe things not to be true, which is not the case for people who get their news from other sources. You know, I have my own personal criticisms of CNN and MSNBC, but...
That's why I feel like you should have a fair and balanced appetite.
Well, that's why I'm asking you to be fair and balanced what you're saying. You know, tell me what MSNBC is missing. I'll tell you what I think they're missing. They're not talking about, you know, monopolies in corporations. They're not talking about media monopolies. They're not talking about, you know, breaking up big media monopolies. They're not talking about how our tax rates have wiping out our tax rates has made a whole bunch of billionaires and has destroyed the middle class. They're not talking about the things that giant corporations, frankly, would rather you not talk about. They're not talking about net neutrality, which they lobbied against. Those are topics you won't hear discussed on CNN or MSNBC. I'll put that right out there. But, you know, gun control? No, I hear lots of conversation about gun control, pro and con on both networks. But anyhow, David, that's not what you called about, is it? It says here polarization in politics.
No, I actually wanted to get the polarization of politics. And I specifically, two of the most polarizing people on the right, I just wanted your personal opinion on them, Steven Crowder and Ben Shapiro. I wanted to know if you personally thought that their outlets are something that average person should be
David,
listening
David, I just have no idea.
There.
You know, I used to debate Ben back 10 years ago. I haven't, but he hasn't been on the show in forever, and I have not, you know, caught either of their programs. So, you know, got nothing there for you. Richard in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I got two comments to make about Bernie's campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I was in my mid-20s when Bobby Kennedy's campaign was going on, 68, and the excitement that Bernie's generating with young people and people of color reminds me a lot of Bobby Kennedy's campaign in 68.
Me too.
And also the New Hampshire-Iowa primaries, nobody's pointing out that both of those states are conservative states, and Bernie took the popular vote in Iowa, and he won New Hampshire primary.
Yeah, decisively, yes. Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely, and excellent points. And I'm guessing that the Democratic Party is going to be thinking about reorganizing their primary schedule. But I think your points are all well taken, and I do feel the same kind of vibe coming off the Sanders campaign. As I saw, I was a little younger than you. I was a teenager, Richard, in the 60s. But I remember the Bobby Kennedy campaign, and I was personally very excited about it, enthusiastic about it. Richard, thank you for the call. It's great to hear from you. Steve in Peterborough, New Hampshire. Speaking of New Hampshire, Steve in Peterborough, what's up?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a few comments about, you probably remember the book Marshall McLuhan. It was The Media is the Message.
Right.
And I think one of the problems with the TV cable pundits is the fact that they don't have a historical perspective. They see things on an hour-to-hour, day-to-day basis. And you end up with guys like Chuck Todd and Chris Matthews, you know, saying the things that they say, which I think are missing the big picture of the time that we're in.
Well, they're not only are they ahistoric, although Chris Matthews actually has a pretty good understanding of history. And frankly, in Chris Matthews' defense, I believe that when he said that Bernie winning in Nevada was like the Nazis taking France in 1940, what he was talking about is we've hit a tipping point. I mean, there was a point in France in 1940 where the Allied commanders, I guess it was Churchill that Bernie was talking about, said, you know, France has fallen. It's fallen. And what Bernie was saying is basically the Democratic Party has fallen. Now, Chris Matthews might not have been happy about that, but I don't think that he was trying to say that Bernie's a Nazi. I think that the criticism of him for saying that is a little over the top. But what he allowed, and of course, Nicole Wallace, you know, the Republican who helped run the Bush campaign in 2004, what Nicole Wallace said on her show on MSNBC and allowed James Carville to go on and on about on Saturday, made me want to puke. I mean, it was disgusting and sickening. So,
Well, what we don't need is the Neville Chamberlain of the time, because from the reading the books that you've suggested, you know, we are at war right now. And that's basically what Churchill said.
Yes.
You know, there's not time for Neville Chamberlains. And that's kind of what we're seeing from a lot of people.
Yeah, and enough of the Quislings and the Chamberlains in the Democratic Party. Donald Trump is deconstructing democracy, not just in the United States, but all around the world. Steve, thank you for the call. And we need to call it out, and we need to be explicit and clear about it. Got to do it. Tony in Walnut Creek, California, you have a message for California voters?
Yeah, Tom. Just to tag along with what an earlier caller had mentioned about the California primary.
Mm-hmm.
If you are a no-party preference voter, you will have already received a ballot with no presidential candidates on it. However, if you'd like to vote for a Democratic candidate in the primary, you basically have until tomorrow to call or visit your county's polling office to specifically request a mail-in ballot with Democratic Party candidates on it. For those of you who are going to be voting in person, you can take your current ballot that doesn't have any presidential candidates on it to your polling place on the day of the election and specifically ask to swap it for a ballot with the Democratic presidential.
But you must bring your ballot with you. This is the biggest problem that we had in the primary in 2016 was people who were listed as no party preference or people who were listed as vote by mail. When they showed up to vote, because they hadn't mailed in the vote-by-mail ballot, some of them didn't even recall receiving it. If you don't bring that vote-by-mail ballot with you, you will be given a provisional ballot, which may well not be counted, because they'll think you're trying to double vote. So be sure to physically carry it with you to the polls. Do I have that right, Tony?
Correct.
Yeah. And this California primary is actually a very, very big deal, and it's going to be happening. It's on Super Tuesday this year, right? California is.
Yep.
Yeah, it's joining everybody else, yeah, which is, you know, it's just a week away. So this is a big deal. Tony, thank you for the call, and thanks for the reminder. Alessio in Los Angeles. Hey, Alessio, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hello, Tom. I'm really a big admirer of your program, and I really love what you do, and thank you for that. First of all, pardon my English. I'm really bad at it.
Your English is better than my Spanish or German. So you're doing good.
Well, my question, Tom, is that we have always criticized Cuba, and we have always said that it is a really bad system. My question is, how do we know how the Cuban system the communism would have progressed if the United States had put that embargo? I mean, away after Batista.
And I agree. And you know, Obama tried to fix this, to his credit. You know, and Obama went to Cuba. He was the first American president to go to Cuba since the overthrow of Batista. And, you know, he went to Cuba and he spoke well of Cuba and he spoke well of their education and healthcare system. And he spoke well of the fact that they have largely dialed back on the political repression. And also they're allowing limited capitalism. You can start your own business. You can start your own store. You can start your own restaurant.
Absolutely.
You just can't serve more than 50 people and you can't own more than one business. And I think this is all great. I mean, when I was in Cuba, when Louise and I were in Cuba a year ago, March, we were just very, very impressed. And now, of course, Trump has reversed all that stuff as a sop to the Marco Rubio crowd, you know, to the right-wing Cubans in Florida who want their money back that Castro took away, that they had made under Batista. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
No, and I agree with that. Is the thing is that we criticize the system. We really don't know how would have progressed if it wasn't only the embargo, but the propaganda against the system.
Yeah.
The propaganda has been so, horrendous that we really don't know.
I agree.
And
I agree with you, Alicia.
I read about the system and I read about socialism. anarchism and all that, those ism stuff. But the real truth is that we don't know if it wasn't for the embargo and the propaganda.
I think it's very possible that had there not been an embargo and had there been a lot of American tourists going to Cuba, even during the darkest days, that Cuba would have opened up and would have changed itself, and it would have been a good thing. No doubt about it.
That's true.
A lot for the call, Alicia. George in Garden City, Kansas. George, I just have 30 seconds. Got a quick one here for me?
Yeah. Real quick, you're a previous guest, Marion.
Yeah.
I think he's just bringing back the Red Scare. There's a communist under every bed, just like, you know, like in the 50s. And if and when Bernie wins the nomination, I hope he does, there is going to be such a campaign by just people like him, and that's just going to snowball, and they're just going to hang that kind of crap all over Bernie.
I agree, George. That's why I gave you a preview of it today. Get ready.
Okay, well, you keep it up. Thanks.
Okay, bye. Thanks a lot, George. Good to hear from you. And, and of course, let's keep in mind, the Republicans called Franklin Roosevelt a communist. They called Harry Truman a communist. They called Jack Kennedy a communist. They called Lyndon Johnson a communist. They called Jimmy Carter a communist. They called Ted Kennedy a communist. And they are going to call whoever the Democratic nominee is a communist. And it was BS back then, and it's BS now about socialism. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Our book today is Why Women Have Better Sex Under Socialism and Other Arguments for Economic Independence by Kristen Godsey. And this is from the introduction titled You Might Be Suffering from Capitalism. The argument of this book can be summed up succinctly. Unregulated capitalism is bad for women. And if we adopt some ideas from socialism, women will have better lives. If done properly, socialism leads to economic independence, better labor conditions, better work-family balance, and yes, even better sex. Finding a way into a better future requires learning from the mistakes of the past, including a thoughtful assessment of the history of 20th century state socialism in Eastern Europe. That's it. If you like the idea of such outcomes, then come along for an exploration of how we might change things. If you're dubious because you don't understand why capitalism as an economic system is uniquely bad for women, and if you doubt that there could ever be anything good about socialism, this short treatise will provide some illumination. If you don't give a whit about women's lives because you're a gynophobic right-wing internet troll, save your money and go back to your parents' basement right now. This isn't the book for you. Of course, some might argue that unregulated capitalism sucks for almost everyone, but I want to focus on how capitalism disproportionately harms women. Competitive labor markets discriminate against those whose reproductive biology makes them primarily responsible for childbearing. Today, this means humans who get pink hats in the hospital and the letter F next to the name on the birth certificate, as if we've already failed by not coming into the world as a boy. Competitive labor markets also devalue those expected to be the primary caregivers of children. Although societal attitudes have evolved in this regard, our idealization of motherhood means that most of us still believe that baby needs mama a whole lot more than papa, at least until the child is old enough to play sports. Others will argue that unregulated capitalism is not bad for all women. Yes, for those women lucky enough to sit at the top of the income distribution, the system works pretty well, although women at the executive level still face gender pay gaps and remain underrepresented in leadership positions. On the whole, things aren't too shabby for the Sheryl Sandbergs of the world. Of course, sexual harassment still hinders progress, even for those at the top, and too many women believe that if you want to run with the big dogs, you may have to suck it up and ignore the groping and unwanted advances. And race plays an important role as well. White women do a lot better in aggregate than do women of color. But when we look at society as a whole, on average, women are comparatively worse off in countries where markets are less encumbered by regulation, taxation, and public enterprises than they are in nations where state revenues support greater levels of redistribution and larger social safety nets. Choose your data source, and you find the same story. Unemployment and poverty plague women with children. Employers discriminate against women without children because they might have them in the future. In the United States in 2013, women over the age of 65 suffered from poverty at much greater rates than men and dominated those in the category of extreme poverty. Globally, women face higher rates of economic deprivation. Women are often the last to be hired and the first to be fired in cyclical downturns. And when they do find employment, bosses pay them less than men. When states need to slash government spending on education, health care, or old age pensions, mothers, daughters, sisters, and wives must pick up the slack, diverting their energy to care for the young, the sick, and the elderly. Capitalism thrives on women's unpaid labor in the home because women's care work supports lower taxes. Lower taxes mean higher profits for those already at the top of the income ladder, mostly men. But capitalism was not always so savage. Throughout much of the 20th century, state socialism presented an existential challenge to the worst excesses of the free market. The threat posed by Marxist ideologies forced Western governments to expand social safety nets to protect workers from the unpredictable but inevitable booms and busts of the capitalist economy. After the Berlin Wall fell, many celebrated the triumph of the West, consigning socialist ideas to the dustbin of history. But for all its faults, state socialism provided an important foil for capitalism. It was in response to a global discourse of social and economic rights, a discourse that appealed not only to the progressive populations of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, but also to many men and women in Western Europe and North America, that politicians agreed to improve working conditions for wage laborers, as well as to create social programs for children, the poor, the elderly, the sick, and the disabled, mitigating exploitation and the growth of income inequality. Although there were important antecedents in the 1980s, once state socialism collapsed, capitalism shook off the constraints of market regulation and income redistribution. Without the looming threat of a rival superpower, the last 30 years of global neoliberalism have witnessed a rapid shriveling of social programs that protect citizens from cyclical instability and financial crises, and reduce the vast inequality of economic outcomes between those at the top and those at the bottom of the income distribution. For much of the 20th century, Western capitalist countries also endeavored to outdo the East European countries in terms of women's rights, fueling progressive social change. For example, the state socialists in the USSR and Eastern Europe were so successful at giving women economic opportunities outside the home that initially, for the two decades after the end of World War II, women's wage work was conflated with the evils of communism. The American way of life meant male breadwinners and female homemakers. But slowly, socialist championing of women's emancipation began to chip away at the Leave It to Beaver ideal. The Soviet launch of Sputnik in 1957 spurred American leaders to rethink the costs of maintaining traditional gender roles. They feared the state socialists enjoyed an advantage in technological development, and why women have better sex under socialism. We'll be back with more of the news and more of my thoughts and yours in this kind of national town hall meeting we have here every day on the Tom Hartman program. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Never was intended to be. It requires you. So get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
So when you look in the mirror, do you see wrinkles around your eyes, crow's feet, a large under eye bags? Would you rather not see them? Imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery. Just gone in minutes. It's called Plexaderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Don't believe it? Try it. You won't have to imagine anymore. You'll look just like you, only 10 years younger. Plexaderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is Plexaderm goes on clear, so nobody will even know you're using it. Go to TryPlexaderm.com and use my code VOICES for 50% off a full-size bottle of Plexaderm, plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an extra $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning the code VOICES. Plexaderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit TryPlexaderm.com today and use the code VOICES at checkout. That's TryPlexaderm.com, code VOICES.